Welcome back to another episode of Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. It's me, DJ Scrappy, and if you're turning in to us today, it is another beautiful Friday, April the 3rd. Here on Worldwise today, we're going to be talking about California farmers in the face of this drought, rodent romance, specifically love songs sung by male rodents, and then another rodent population, rabbits, and how scientists are trying to map them. Further on, we're going to talk about smart clothing, as in clothing technology that can help you in your workout. Then after that, we'll be talking about the algae in Lake Erie and how scientists are trying to reduce that. Then Airbnb adds Cuba to its destination list. Later on, we'll be talking about online searching and how that might make you think you're smarter than you actually are. Then drug-resistant food poisoning and how it is entering the United States. Then Icefin, a robot that's exploring Antarctica. Afterwards, honeybees and their decline and how scientists have ordered a halt to some insecticides in America. Then the Large Hadron Collider, which was up and running last week but suffered a glitch, and we'll have more on that later. As well as a virus in your mouth that helps you fight the flu. But our first story today is going to be on an alien camel skeleton that was discovered on the Danube River. So the skeleton of a camel that lived in the 17th century during the Habsburg Wars with the Ottoman Empire has been discovered in a refuse pit in Austria. The animal would have been somewhat of an alien along the Danube River in Tallinn, Austria, the researchers said, because calling it a sunken ship in the desert, really. Camels are alien species in Europe and Austria, and the town of Tallinn is closely situated to the large river streams of the Danube, says Alfred Gaelic, a researcher at the University of Veterinary Medicine at Vienna, and one of the scientists who worked on the study detailing the discovery. The sunken ship phrase should bring together this buried sunken ship of the desert with Tallinn and the Danube, a place where no camels naturally appear, Gaelic told Life Science in an email. And rather than a beast of burden, this camel was likely a valuable riding animal, as the researchers found no clear signs of arthritis on the camel's bones. Rather, symmetrical marks on the shoulder blades and parts of the humerus bones likely resulted from the stress of a rider getting on and off the camel. The camel also had unusual parents. It was born to a Bactrian camel, that's the camel that has two humps, and its mother was a dromedary, or a one-hump camel. Those are basically the two types of camels that we have. The researchers also found, looking at the bones and analyzing the camel's DNA, that it came mostly from the Bactrian line. The cross between the one-hump dromedary and the two-hump Bactrian resulted in a camel with one really large hump, says Gaelic. Such crossbreeding was not unusual at the time, and Gaelic says in a statement that hybrids were easier to handle, more enduring and larger than their parents, and these animals were especially suited for military use. If we think about horses and donkeys, when they crossbreed, they have burrows, which are more efficient than a horse. They require less water. But getting back to this story, though, as for how the camel got to Tolan, Austria, the researchers speculated that perhaps it came from the Ottoman army when Tolan was being attacked. That means the cadaver was not butchered and the flesh was not used. What remains as an untypical behavior, especially in times of war, says Gallic. The Tolan inhabitants may not have wanted to eat the flesh of the camel because it was such an alien animal, he added. The camel, whose remains were found in a natural post-death position, with its neck bent backward and its legs pulled up toward its body, was an adult male, older than 7 years when it died, says the researchers. So it's strange to find a camel that far north in Europe, but given the context, it doesn't seem too strange. Although I've never seen a hybrid between a dromedary and a Bactrian camel before. This is DJ Scrappy, and you're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. And our next story is all about California farmers. So it's scary times right now for California farmers, and as snowpack hits the record lows, it's just going to get worse. The water outlook in drought-racked California right now just got a little worse. Snowpack levels across the entire Sierra Nevada are now the lowest in a record history. In recorded history, rather. Just 6% of the long-term average. That shatters the previous low record on this date of 25% set in 1977 and again last year. And it has huge implications for tens of millions of people who depend on water flowing downstream from melting snow, including the nation's most productive farming region, the California Central Valley. Last year was already a tough year at La Jolla Farming in Delano, California. Or as farmer manager Jerry Schlitz puts it, last year was damn near a disaster. La Jolla is a vineyard, 1,000 or so acres of neat lines of grapevines in the southern end of the San Joaquin Valley. It depends on water from two sources, one, the Federal Central Valley Project, and the other, wells. Until last year, Schlitz says, wells were used to supplement the federal water. He says, now we have nothing but wells. Nothing. There's no water other than what's coming out of the ground, he says. Last year, one of those wells at La Jolla dried up. The farm lost 160 acres, about $1 million worth of produce, plus the wasted labor and other resources. This year, the outlook is no better. The Central Valley Project, which decides where and when to release what water is left in California's reservoirs, has already warned that most farmers downstream won't get any water for the second straight year. As reported on KQED, more than 400,000 acres of farmland were fallowed last year because of scarce water. Credible sources have estimated that figure could double this year. La Jolla is plowing miles of trench in the dry earth to bury water pipes connecting wells to fields and fields to wells. The farm owners want to make sure that they can move water from working wells to the places that they need it. We're getting prepared in case we lose one. We lost two. We lose three. Watch out, man. I'm going to unemployment, says Juvenal Montemayor, the owner and founder of La Jolla. He says this is the best they can do. Now, drilling a new well isn't a short-term option. You try to get a well done right, you know. No way. It's like a 2-year waiting time for wells, he says. Then there's the cost. $500,000 for a single well. Now, ask me if I want to make a well. No, I don't want to make a well. I don't have a choice, says Montemayor. I don't have a choice. And that's the tough situation La Jolla and many other farmers in the Central Valley face. They won't be getting any federal water. Groundwater reserves are getting lower and lower as farmers and towns drill deeper and deeper, sucking out more water than is coming in. It's gotten so bad in the San Joaquin Valley that the ground is actually sinking. Last summer, it sank 0.5 inch each month. That's pretty alarming. Back among the grapevines of La Jolla, Schlitz points to the mountains on the horizon, their tops barely sprinkled with snow. The snow supplies, roughly a third of all of California's water, on average. The Sierra Nevada snowpack is supposed to be a storage bank. It holds the snow late into the spring that then melts gradually. The runoff feeds reservoirs that supply water for millions of people and the Central Valley. This year, California's chief snow surveyor says there may not even be a runoff. "That's our lifeblood up there," says Schlitz. "Whatever comes out of there, you know, that's our lifeblood." Schlitz says it's a scary time. And Schlitz, I agree with you. And that is a good analogy, our lifeblood. So if the water runs out, you know, what are we going to do? Moving on, I have a story about rodents, mice in particular, and the love songs they sing to woo their ladies. So this comes from Reuters. "Some people want to fill the world with silly love songs, and what's wrong with that? I'd like to know," Paul McCartney sings in his 1976 song, Silly Love Songs. Mice just might agree. So it turns out male mice actually use ultrasonic love songs to woo females, using different tunes when they smell but do not see a female, and when they lay eyes on their potential lady, scientists said on Wednesday. "I do think there is more going on with animal communication than we humans have been attuned to," says Duke University neurobiology professor Eric Jarvis. He also says there is a clear communication signal in the mouse songs and not just random sequences of vocalizations. The researchers compared the songs to the courtship songs of male songbirds, although mice are more limited in their ability to modify their tunes. The mouse songs are a sequence of utterances or syllables strung together, at times with a tempo. So those songs are really high in pitch, above 50 kilohertz, and are not audible to humans. When we pitch them down and play back at real speed, it sounds kind of like a bird, says Duke postdoctoral fellow Jonathan Chabot. Scientists have known for decades that mice make such sounds, like when a pup calls for its mother, and have worked to better understand what they communicate. The researchers exposed male lab mice to different situations and recorded their songs, then analyzed them. The males sang more complex and louder songs when they were able to smell the urine of a female mouse, but not actually see that potential mate. With the female present, the males changed their tune with longer, simpler songs. "I think mice are saying with the complex songs, pay attention to me, I'm here, come to me, and see how my complex song sounds great, as a measure of, well, his health. Then the female assesses it, and he simplifies the song when she's directly next to him in order to spend energy to try to mate," says Jarvis. So that's pretty interesting. And the researchers played the two song types to sexually mature females, finding they preferred spending time next to speakers playing the complex song. Whether or not it's a specific syllable type or something else in the complex song, we don't know, says Chabot. The research was published in the journal Frontiers of Behavioral Neuroscience. So if you want to learn more, the journal Frontier is for you. So you're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. I'm DJ Scrappy, and I will be right back with you with another tantalizing topic, more rodents. So stay tuned.
Yellow.
All right, we're back with some more Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu, and it's April 3rd. So, if you are just joining us, we talked about an alien camel skeleton that was discovered in Austria, and then we went on to talk about the drought and how it's affecting farmers, and a little bit about rodent love, and now we have some more rodents, or rabbits, rather. So, scientists want your help in mapping the population of rabbits and hares. The animals are easier to spot in spring when vegetation is low and the breeding season is underway. Hares may be declining in parts of the UK, while rabbits have been hit by myxomatosis and other viral diseases, says Mammal Society. People are being asked to send in photographs of rabbits and hares to help map the UK population. Dr. Fiona Matthews, senior lecturer in mammalian biology and chair of the Mammal Society, said, "We have a very poor information on rabbits and hares, and it's important to note if numbers are going up or down. They are part of the ecosystem, and lots of other animals depend on them, either through grazing of their habitat or as a food source for foxes or birds of prey." Dr. Fiona Matthews also said some parts of the UK had very very low populations of rabbits and hares, particularly where there had been disease outbreaks. However, in other regions, they had become so abundant that they have become an agricultural pest. The Mammal Society wants people across the country to send in sightings of wild rabbits or hares across the countryside, including the parks, the fields, the dales, the mountains. The data will be used in a national atlas of mammals to support future conservation and research projects. Derek Crawley, who is coordinating the atlas, said rabbits and hares can be distinguished by their gait and appearance. Hares are larger and have long limbs and lollop along, whereas the rabbit has a bobbing gait, said Crawley. The ears are also distinctive. Those of hares are longer and have black tips. Sightings of rabbits and hares or their signs in the countryside, such as droppings and burrows, with any photographs taken, can be reported via the Mammal Tracker app from the Mammal Society website or by posting information to the Mammal Society. So, again, that disease that is hitting rabbits in the UK is called myxomatosis. So it's taking out large population bases, I'd say, in different areas. So that's a little unsettling because that'll change a lot of the ecosystem. All right, next here on Worldwise, will smart clothing amp up your workout? So when Eric Blue goes to the gym, he sports a wafer-thin shirt that tracks his every move. Blue's shirt contains tiny sensors woven into the fabric. They monitor his heart rate, the calories he burns, and other metrics like breathing. A companion app on his smartphone informs him about the intensity of his workouts. Blue, a Los Angeles entrepreneur, says regular use of the shirt has pushed him to up his game during exercise. This is no ordinary t-shirt either. It represents the evolution of the wearable tech trend from accessories like watches and bands like Fitbits to clothing. Blue, who's 38, was among the first people to buy a biometric shirt from the Montreal-based startup Hexoskin. Blue is a self-professed fitness junkie who goes to the gym at least 5 times each week, so he said the shirt is worth a $3.99 price tag. For Blue, it's far easier to throw on a Hexoskin shirt and go rather than fiddle with a smartphone or chest strap. "My old heart rate monitor is now sitting in the closet gathering dust," he said. "It sounds very sci-fi right now, but in the future, all the personal data being collected by health and fitness sensors and smartwatches will alternatively be readily available in our clothing." Blue isn't alone in embracing smart clothing, however. Athletes, astronauts, and, of all people, Cirque du Soleil performers have espoused the benefits of using Hexoskin and other smart clothing products. Smart shirts, athletic pants, and socks started hitting stores last year. But medical experts say they hope patients with serious or chronic metal conditions also can benefit from smart clothing. These companies will hit fitness fans first, said Stephanie Telanius, founder of Vita, a mobile app that matches sick patients with personal health coaches. But I see huge potential for chronic care. It's still early for smart clothing, but the technology is evolving rapidly. One company, Athos, based in Redwood City, California, is developing garments that can track people's muscle activity. Sensors can detect how hard muscles are working and whether a user is putting too much pressure on one side of the body, for instance. Athos is focused on reaching passionate exercisers who want to make improvements to their exercise regimes, said CEO Dahanja Jalaith. I'm going to say that CEO's name again. Dahananja Jalaith. Yeah, okay, so that one is kind of a tongue twister. Anyways, Mr. Jalaith says, the people who buy our stuff are into fitness. They typically spend a lot of time working out. So, of course, that's their market. As is the case with many startups, Jalaith started Athos to solve a personal problem. He came up with the idea while studying electrical engineering in college. Jalaith, who frequently goes to the gym, said he couldn't stop thinking about whether technology could replace a personal trainer. After we came up with the idea, people told us we were crazy and it wasn't possible, he said. It took Jalaith, a fellow electrical engineer, 5 years to build a working prototype. The apparel can track muscle activity, heart rate, recovery times, and breathing rates. In the past, athletes would have needed to be hooked up to a machine in a performance lab to access all this information. Like the Hexoskin apparel, these products won't come cheap. Athos shorts or shirts will cost $99 each and will require a $199 sensor that fits in a pocket on the garment. Although Jayala didn't intend the products to be used for sick people, Athos has already received interest from the medical community. The company anticipates that its clothing will eventually be used in clinical settings such as hospitals and rehabilitation clinics. Smart clothing could benefit patients with a variety of medical conditions, including heart disease and obesity. Gradually, over the next few years, these low-cost, consumer-focused, data-rich devices and apps will bring to bear vastly more data than physicians have in some circumstances, said Pete Morin, a general partner at the venture capital firm DCM, which invested in Athos. Fitness shirts could find a market in rehabilitation and could facilitate home exercises. That's just a thought, said Dr. Molly Malouf, a general practitioner based in San Francisco, who has been closely following the wearable tech trend. But selling wearables as medical devices comes with strings attached. It would be far easier for a product like this to remain in the wellness category, said Morgan Reed, executive director at the App Association, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that works with patient advocates and app developers. By saying they are helping to improve fitness and well-being, Reed said, these companies may hope to avoid stricter regulatory oversight as medical devices by the Food and Drug Administration. And many physicians are not convinced that the data these devices gather is reliable enough to be used for patient care. This mistrust doesn't just apply to smart clothing, but the wearable tech trend in general. There has been an explosion in patient-generated data, but much of it may not be useful to physicians in the short term, said Dr. Pat Basu, chief medical officer at Doctor on Demand, an app that connects people to doctors. If a patient is showing me their blood pressure or heart rate they gathered from an app or device, I'll always ask myself, is the fidelity of this information accurate or not? Wearable tech makers should produce reports about each patient that doctors and nurses can skim, Basu says. Many physicians are already inundated with the wealth of data that patients are generating from new wearable apps and devices. Moreover, some doctors fear that they will be liable if they miss something in the growing pile of patient data. Privacy is another concern. The App Association's Reed says he's satisfied that patients' sensitive health information is protected, for now. But Reed expressed fears that the next crop of smart clothing companies might opt to offset the high cost of their products by selling people's health data to pharmaceutical companies or insurance providers and, well, even employers. Would consumers understand that they're buying the version that is monitoring through data sharing? Reed said, that's the problem that everyone in the wearable industry is working on right now. So, yeah, they talked about buying and selling your personal data, which, you know, is likely possible. But I wonder if you're at the gym, can someone who also has a sensor right next to you hack into your device and get all your vitals? So it's something to think about. I'm DJ Scrappy, and this is Worldwise, a show about science, technology, the environment, interesting things, and all things in between. Our next story here is about Lake Erie and new rules that the governor of Ohio has put into place to help reduce algae. So, Oregon, Ohio. Ohio's efforts to slow down the spread of toxic algae in Lake Erie will soon force some farmers to change how they handle livestock manure and require more testing for pollutants at the state's largest wastewater treatment plants. Legislation signed Thursday by Governor John Kasich also will create a new state coordinator to oversee the monitoring, treating, and testing of algae. What remains unknown is how farmers and cities will pay for some of the changes that state leaders say are needed to improve water quality and avoid a repeat of last summer when toxins from the algae contaminated drinking water of more than 400,000 people in northwestern Ohio and southeastern Michigan. One potential solution to Ohio's funding dilemma is a statewide ballot issue in the early stages of development, according to a state lawmaker looking into the idea. The plan would be to ask voters to approve a bond issue that could raise millions for Ohio cities with aging wastewater systems that dump tons of raw sewage into rivers during heavy rains and pay for fixes to leaking septic systems. Farmers, including those in the northwestern corner of Ohio, who will no longer be allowed to spread manure or on frozen or rain-soaked fields under the new legislation signed Thursday, could share some of the bond money to construct storage for livestock waste during the winter months. This would allow us to start addressing the bigger picture across all of the state, said State Rep Dave Hall, a Republican from Eastern Ohio. All these issues are contributing to water quality concerns in Lake Erie and the state's rivers and lakes, but federal money to fix them is limited and many cities can't afford the millions it would cost. These bonded funds would help to remove the sticker shock, says Hall. Kasich, who has made it a priority to solve the algae problem, said the wide-ranging legislation that regulates manure and seeks to end the dumping of dredged sediment in the lake within 5 years is only part of the solution. Fixing septic and wastewater systems are part of it too, he said just outside Toledo, Ohio, where he signed the bill into law near the lakefront. We're looking at those areas that are the most vulnerable and figuring out if we can help out to some degree. But the state of Ohio can't buy everyone a septic system. It's just impossible. Farmers might be able to tap into state or federal funds to help them comply with the new regulations, said Jim Zeringer, the state's natural resources director. How much it will cost those farmers will vary depending on the size and type of farm, as well as whether they decide to store the manure on site, buy new equipment that injects the waste into the ground, or pay someone else to get rid of it. You can assume it's not going to be small, said Joe Cornelly, a spokesman for the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. A medium-sized dairy farm with 200 cows might expect to spend around $60,000 for a manure pit with a plastic liner, said Von Brubaker, owner of Manada Construction Co. in Myerstown, Pennsylvania, which installs manure storage systems. The upfront expense might be eye-popping, but he said farmers will be able to use the manure later on their fields and reduce the amount they spend on chemical fertilizers. It isn't as expensive as they think, he says. So it sounds to me this is a problem with infrastructure in a key region. The Great Lakes system is a very unique ecosystem, and having large-scale algae blooms on it is not good, and it's not very good for the drinking water of those 400,000 people in Ohio and Michigan either. So, moving on, we're going to talk to you about Airbnb. We've all heard of Airbnb. It's an app that connects travelers with people who might have a couch or a bed for you to crash on. And so Airbnb is adding Cuba to its destination list for U.S. travelers. More than 1,000 properties in the Caribbean nation are already listed, but can only be booked by users in the U.S. The San Francisco-based site is restricted from showing the listings elsewhere because of a U.S. trade embargo against the island. Nevertheless, Airbnb said Cuba could eventually become one of the biggest markets in Latin America. "We are actually plugging into an existing culture of micro-enterprise in Cuba," said the firm's regional director, Kay Quinn. "The hosts in Cuba have been renting out rooms to travelers for decades." One expert, however, said the site faced some major challenges. While Airbnb is a valuable alternative for millions of travelers, in the context of Cuba, because of the high margins it takes from every transaction, it won't necessarily meet with great success, said travel writer Simon Calder. "All the Cuban bed and breakfast providers I know would like to keep all the money rather than handing 15% or more to an American corporation," he added, referring to the total amount the firm deducts from both the host and the guest. "The other thing is that anybody who has used the internet in Cuba will know that a prospective host is unlikely to be able to respond immediately, given the shockingly slow internet there," which reminds one of what you'd find in the early 90s. The initial listings range from around 10 euros a night for a private room in Trinidad to 695 a night for the whole of a five-bedroom chalet in Havana. Airbnb visitors outside the U.S. can view the listings, but can only add them to their wish list rather than book them. An on-screen alert states that the site is not licensed to provide booking services to others. The U.S. recently began allowing Americans to travel to the island if they obtained a special license, which can be granted for activities including family visits, educational activities, and public performances. The White House said it would like tourism to be added to the list, and President Obama has urged Congress to begin work to drop the wider sanctions. "We are ending a policy that was long past its expiration date," he said in his State of the Union address in January. The move made it possible for online film streaming sites like Netflix to be launched in Cuba the following month, which Freedom of Speech campaign group Freedom House said was more symbolic than anything else, in the short term because of the country's exceptionally low connectivity. Visitors across the globe can still find listings for Cuba-based rooms via other U.S. services, including TripAdvisor, which allows users to contact hosts directly, but does not take a cut of the bookings itself. Simon Calder, however, criticized the absurdity of the fact that several other U.S.-based travel sites, including Kayak and Booking.com, continue to ignore the island's existence. "Anybody trying to find a flight to Havana on a U.S. airline website will be assured that the city does not exist," he says. So more exciting news in the warming trend with our neighbor in the south, Cuba. You're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. If you're just joining us, we talked about the drought, rodent romance, the rabbit population in the UK, and wearable smart clothing that you can take to the gym, algae in Lake Erie, and just now about Airbnb adding Cuba to its destination list. If you stick with us, we're going to go over how searching online may make you think you're smarter than you actually are, how drug-resistant food poisoning has hit the United States, and a robot called Icefin exploring the Antarctica. So stick with us, and we will be right back. For what? Some more Worldwise. All the All right, welcome back to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. This is your host, DJ Scrappy. I hope you guys have been having a wonderful Friday morning. It's actually Good Friday, and a lot of the school today is not here. But I'm here with you. I don't know how your week has been going. Mine so-so. Anyways, back to science, technology, and the environment. Let's talk about your online searching habits. So, you may think you're pretty smart with your smartphone in your pocket. Ask it any question, and you'll probably get a bunch of answers immediately. Well, using the internet is an easy way to feel omniscient, yes, enter a search term, and the answers appear before your eyes. But at any moment, you're also just a few taps away from becoming an insufferable know-it-all. Searching for answers online gives an inflated sense of your own knowledge, according to a new study. It makes people think they know more than they actually do. We think the information is leaking into our head, but really the information is stored somewhere else entirely, says Matthew Fisher, a doctoral student in cognitive psychology at Yale University. Fisher surveyed hundreds of people to get a sense of how searching the internet affected how they rate their knowledge. His study was published Tuesday in the Journal of Experimental Psychology, General. Fisher began with a simple survey. He asked questions such as, how does a zipper work? Or, why are there leap years? He allowed just half of his subjects to use the internet to answer the question. Then he asked the subjects to rate how well they thought they could answer a question unrelated to the first question, such as, why does Swiss cheese have holes? Or, how do tornadoes form? People who had been allowed to search online tended to rate their knowledge higher than people who answered without any outside sources. To reveal factors that might explain why the internet group rated their knowledge higher, he designed follow-up experiments using different groups of people. First, he asked people to rate their knowledge before the test. There was no difference between subjects' ratings, but afterwards, the internet enabled subjects again rated their knowledge better than the others. Next, Fisher tried to make sure that people saw the exact same information. He told the internet-enabled group, please search for the scientificamerican.com page with this information. The non-search group was sent directly to the page. Fisher checked that the two groups used the same URL. Still, the people who could actively search rated their knowledge higher than those who simply saw the information. And this is just a taste of the experiments Fisher ran. He also compared different search engines, reworded his questions to make it clear that he wasn't asking for only the subject's knowledge, not the internet's. Made the online searchers use filters that would keep any relevant results from showing up. He also asked questions for which there were no answers online, such as, how do wheat fields affect the weather? And he also asked people to choose one of several brain scans that most resembled their brain. The people who had been searching online picked the image with the most activity. Interesting. The results kept coming back the same. Searching online led to knowledge inflation. There are practical consequences to this little exercise. If we can't accurately judge what we know, then who's to say whether any of the decisions we make are well informed? People are unlikely to be able to explain their own shortcomings, says Fisher. People aren't aware of the quality of explanation or the quality of arguments they can produce, and they don't realize it until they encounter the gaps. The more we rely on the internet, Fisher says, the harder it will be to draw a line between where our knowledge ends and the web begins. And unlike poring through books or debating peers, asking the internet is unique because it's really effortless. We are not forced to face our own ignorance and ask for help. We can just look up the answer immediately, Fisher writes in an email. We think these features make it more likely for people to consider knowledge stored online as their own. So, maybe next time someone asks you a question, keep the phone in your pocket. Next up, drug-resistant food poisoning lands in the United States, which is a scary thought. This time last year, a painful new virus was knocking on our doorstep. travelers were bringing chikungunya, yeah, to the U.S., and eventually the mosquito-borne viruses set up shop in Florida. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says another nasty pathogen is hitching a ride to the U.S. with travelers. Multi-drug-resistant Shigella. Shigella is just about as bad as the word sounds. The bacteria infect your intestines and trigger crampy rectal pain, bloody or mucus-laced diarrhea, and vomiting. Sounds like a bad case of food poisoning to me. Multi-drug-resistant Shigella has caused several outbreaks over the past year in the U.S., the CDC reported last Thursday in the journal Morbidity and Mortality Weekly. At least 243 people have gotten sick, and about 20% were hospitalized. Those numbers may not sound like much, especially when you consider 500,000 Americans get regular shigellosis each year. So Shigella is the more virulent one, and if you've had food poisoning in the past, shigellosis is probably what you've had. So what's the big deal? Well, this strain of Shigella is resistant to the go-to drug for the bacteria, ciprofloxacin. If rates of resistance become this high in more places, we'll have very few options left for treating Shigella with antibiotics by mouth, says epidemiologist Anna Bowen, who led this study. Then doctors will have to resort to IV antibiotics. Shigella is incredibly contagious. It spreads through contaminated food and water. As few as 10 germs can cause an infection, Bowen says. That's much less than some other diarrhea-causing germs. From May to February, the cipro-resistant strain popped up in 32 states with large clusters in California, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. Bowen and her team linked several of these outbreaks to international travel, including trips to India, the Dominican Republic, and Morocco. But in many instances, people who got sick hadn't traveled outside the U.S., so the strain has already started to circulate in some states, says Bowen. The outbreak really highlights that multi-drug resistance in other countries is also a problem for the United States. Cases in the U.S. have continued to accrue over the month since this was all put together in the report, so they're still monitoring it very carefully. Most of the time, shigellosis will go away on its own after about 7 days. In rare cases, it causes severe blood infections and even death. Around the world, 100 million people get infected with Shigella each year, and about 600,000 of them die. So, wow. 500,000 people die from this out of the 100 million that get it. Cipro-resistant shigellosis is a growing problem globally, especially in Asia. Bowen says that the best way to prevent Shigella is vigilant hygiene. Wash your hands regularly while traveling and choose foods wisely. So, say you're walking down the street in Thailand, maybe not go for the street food. Taking over-the-counter drugs like calpectate, and Pepto-Bismol can prevent travelers' diarrhea, she says. And if you do get sick, don't reach for the Cipro first. Instead, Bowen says, go for an over-the-counter anti-diarrheal drug before trying an antibiotic. So ease off the antibiotics unless you really need them. Next up, what do I have for you? I have a robot named Icefin, and today he's exploring Antarctica's dark depths. And tomorrow, well, he might find himself on Europa. One of the moons of Jupiter, rather. So, the Icefin sounds like a name, you know, from a new James Bond film, and actually it could be at home in one. The robotic vehicle was deployed at the end of last year by a team of scientists and engineers from the Georgia Institute of Technology through about 65 feet of ice and 1,640 feet of water to the seafloor in Antarctica. The just-released video above, excuse me, you can't see it, but I can, shows just how it works, and it kind of looks like a manta ray, so it's pretty interesting. And it's been showing us surprising amounts of life on the Antarctic floor, such as sponges, anemones, and even sea stars. We saw evidence of a complex community on the seafloor that has never been observed before, and unprecedented detail on the ice-ocean interface that hasn't been achieved before, says Brittany Schmidt in a new report about the expedition from GT. Schmidt is an assistant professor in the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at GT. I should stop saying GT. GT stands for Georgia Tech. And the principal investigator for the ice fin is Brittany Schmidt. Because ice fin is shaped like a long, thin needle, the researchers were able to deploy it at McMurdo Research Station in Antarctica through a hole with a diameter of only 12 inches. Though it has a slender profile, ice fin is incredibly robust. It has a modular design, which means researchers can swap out different instruments based on their needs, just like many spacecraft. That's fitting, as ICEFIN was developed as part of NASA's funded Sub-Ice Marine Planetary Analog Ecosystem program, an effort to understand the way icy crusts interface with the water beneath them. What's unique about the vehicle is the combination of size and instrumentation, Schmidt told Crave. Other under-ice vehicles the size of ICEFIN, which is around 200 pounds, are generally only capable of operations under sea ice and depth at range of about 500 feet and with low instrumentation, meaning a camera and maybe one or two other instruments. ICEFIN, on the other hand, can handle up to 1.5 kilometers or almost a mile in range of about 2 miles with the same or more instrumentation as vehicles like AutoSub that weigh several tons. For this mission, ICEFIN had 8 instruments aboard, including a range of sensors and up-and-down imaging devices that were designed to work even in the numbing temperatures below the Ross Ice Shelf, where it was deployed. ICEFIN also made use of a navigation system called SLAM, Simultaneous Localization and Mapping, which allowed it to triangulate its position based on measuring the range and bearing of features on the seafloor or under the ice, says the Georgia Tech statement. Because it is portable, we can get into environments further from the front of the ice shelves beyond the range of big vehicles and can even do lakes, Schmidt told the U.S. While ICEFIN is slated to explore the other side of the world, the Arctic, in 2016, the hope is that the technology that's gone into developing it will someday help scientists explore the ice-covered oceans of Jupiter's moon, Europa. We're advancing hypothesis that we need for Europa and understanding ocean systems here better, Schmidt said. We're also developing and getting comfortable with technologies that make polar science and eventually Europa science more realistic. So robotics are advancing at an unbelievable rate, and we've already sent a lot of, satellites as our first pioneers, and now that we're touching down on different planets, robots are taking the lead again. This is DJ Scrappy here on Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu. Next up for you, I have news about the honeybees in the U.S. So scientists, the government, want to halt expanded use of some insecticides because of the rapidly decreasing population of honeybees. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency said on Thursday it was unlikely to approve new or expanded uses of certain pesticides while it evaluates the risks they may pose to honeybees. The so-called neonicotinoid pesticides are routinely used in agriculture and applied to plants and trees in gardens and parks, but their widespread use has come under scrutiny in recent years after a drop in the number of honeybees and other pollinating insects which play key roles in food production. The decline is attributed to factors including pesticide and herbicide use, habitat loss, and disease, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The EPA notice came the day after Oregon's largest city suspended the use of the pesticides on its property to protect honeybees. The unanimous vote on Wednesday by the Portland City Commission came despite protests from farmers, nursery owners, and others who claim the insecticide was crucial in combating pests that destroy crops and other plants. Portland is among at least 8 municipalities that have banned the chemicals. The EPA is conducting an assessment of the 6 types of neonicotinoids and their impact on honeybees, with its evaluation of 4 expected by 2018, and the remaining 2 a year later. In the interim, the agency said in a statement that its moves stemmed from the agency's ongoing effort to protect pollinators, but the federal government, the federal environmental regulators said they would review the suspension if a significant new pest issue should arise that may be uniquely addressed by one of these chemicals. The Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation said the EPA's latest measure on neonicotinoids, which are taken up by plants through roots and leaves, was insufficient. The reality is there are risks to our pollinators with the current uses, of these insecticides, said Amy Code, the Xerces Society's pesticide program coordinator. The EPA and a group representing farmers and other pesticide users could not immediately be reached for comment. So, yeah, those farmers, they weren't reached for comment, but I'm sure they're not elated, and they're part of the people protesting the ban on these pesticides. Well, that is it for Worldwise on Friday, April 3rd, 2015. If you enjoyed my show, I'm glad. If you didn't, well, tune in next week, and I might have a better one for you. You never know. Thank you for tuning in here to Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu. This is DJ Scrappy, and I will see you next Friday.